Okay, I'm going to call to order this Thursday, September 22nd, 2016, meeting of the Senate Interim Committee on Workforce. Welcome, everyone. Colleagues, great to see you. I will say just up front that we are two members short today, both for unhappy reasons, I'm sad to say. Senator Gelzer has lost her grandmother, and so she's back in the Midwest for a funeral. And our dear Senator Thatcher had a very serious accident that she may be in surgery today, or she was yesterday. And she'll be okay, but it's a very serious thing, and we wish her the speediest recovery. So we have a number of topics that we're going to be hearing about today. As is typical in our interim committee meetings, these are informational sessions that allow us to catch up on work that we initiated during the regular session to hear how things are going. We'll be getting a report on where we are in terms of our unemployment numbers, which will be very interesting. And then we'll be hearing about some initiatives that are related to the work that's being done by a couple of our work groups, the one on youth employment, and then I'll be summarizing that work for you, reporting on that work, and also telling you about the other work group, which is the work group on work schedules that work. So let's start off with hearing about the follow-up to the legislation that we did on wage enforcement last session, Senate Bill 1587. And I'll call up Gerhard Trouble from Boley and hear about where we are on the hiring of the new enforcement personnel.
Senator Denbrough, committee members, my name is Gerhard Teubel. I'm the administrator of the Wage and Hour Division at the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries. Thank you for the invitation to update the committee this morning about the Bureau of Labor and Industries activities in the area of division-directed investigations. As Senator Denbrough just reminded us, in the most recent session, the legislature passed Senate Bill 1587, which, among other things, appropriated additional funds to Boley for the purpose of enforcing claims of unpaid wages. Essentially, that appropriation allowed the agency to add three investigator positions to the Wage and Hour Division. The purpose of this appropriation was to permit Boley's Wage and Hour Division to engage, if only on a small scale, in more strategic enforcement of the wage and hour laws by inspecting work sites to check for compliance and, if possible, to prevent violations before they occurred. To carry out these types of investigations, which differ from the normal work that the division does, which is to investigate wage claims filed by individual wage claimants, the division formed a three-person unit staffed by experienced investigators who had previously worked in other areas of the division. Since the latter half of July, these investigators have conducted site visits to about 16 different business locations in various parts of the state to ascertain compliance within the food manufacturing industry, primarily fruit and fish canneries. This particular industry was selected for the initial round of inspections for a number of reasons, primarily the seasonal nature of the work. That is, we wanted to get to these workers while the work was being performed in the canneries, the prevalence of low-wage workers within these industries, and a history of complaints that the Bureau has received from complainants against businesses in this type of industry. On most occasions, the Boley investigators alone conducted these investigations. However, on one occasion, Boley joined with partner agencies in the Interagency Compliance Network to visit a few canneries on the southern Oregon coast. The investigators report that the individuals that they have encountered during these visits have generally been cooperative. And on a couple of occasions, I've had the opportunity to speak with representatives of some of these businesses that have been visited, and they have been generally supportive of this kind of approach to compliance. The outline for one of these investigations is basically this. The unit identifies a geographic area it wants to look at and then identifies businesses within that geographic area that meet the type of industry that the division is investigating. The team members make the site visits. They interview both employers and employees at the site. They check for the required postings on site and then may request time to review time and payroll records that the employers have at the workplace. Depending on the outcome of the inspection, the team members follow up with employers by requesting documentation, which is then reviewed in more depth, and may follow up with further interviews of workers. If the team does happen to find any violations during these inspections, it takes an action which is appropriate to the nature and scope of that violation. Such measures may range from working with an employer to bring them into compliance and then simply getting an agreement that they will continue to comply in the future, or in cases where violations are more egregious or widespread, it may result in the assessment of civil penalties in order to recovering whatever wages and damages may be owed under state law. As you know, the focus of these investigations is to determine whether employees are paid wages as required by state law. But, of course, when the investigators go in, if they find other kinds of violations related to the wage and hour laws, they attempt to correct those as well. So in these early investigations that we have conducted, there have been issues with state sick time, for example, and some child labor issues that were corrected as well. So we attempt to resolve those issues as well as wage issues that we may find. Again, it's very early. We've only been conducting these investigations for a couple of months. We are still in the process of reviewing time and payroll records for some of the businesses which we've investigated. So I'm not able today to give you the results of those investigations, but I do look forward in the future to providing this committee with more detailed information about the outcomes of the investigations that this new unit is conducting. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have about the new unit.
Thank you, Gerhard. And pleased to hear about the progress that's being made and how ultimately quickly these hires were able to be effected. Colleague, any questions? Yes, Senator Rosenbaum.
Thanks a lot, Mr. Chair. Gerhard, this is not directly related to your presentation, but you know, we also in 2016 passed the new minimum wage law, and I know it's not fully phased in yet, but having a pretty innovative system that will be different in Oregon with the three regions. Can you talk a little about how the Wage and Hours Division is going to deal with enforcement as well as just informing the workforce and employers about that we will have these three different minimum wages and how you're going to deal with that?
Sure, Senator Dimbrough, Senator Rosenbaum. At this point, I don't think we have in the Wage and Hour Division, at least, we have received a lot of complaints around the new structure of the minimum wage law. We do get a lot of questions, though, from both workers and employers about how will this work, what does this mean, and I think at this point we are still in that phase where we are largely educating both employers about how to be in compliance with the multiple minimum wage rates, as well as explaining to workers when we do get contact communication with them about how that's going to affect them in their workplace. I think for a lot of both businesses and workers, I mean, probably for the vast majority, the fact that there are three minimum wage rates there will be three minimum wage rates won't be an issue. It's just in certain types of work that may come up. But we have developed, of course, a poster, a new minimum wage poster, which addresses the kernel of the issues regarding the three the three rates, the three regions, how to identify which region applies to the work being performed, as well as other kinds of materials that, that explain the new process.
So just to follow up, will this new unit of investigators, do you think, help monitor how, because I know you said that this won't be confusing, but I'm guessing particularly to the workforce, but probably to employers too, they're not necessarily going to know when the wages do start to diverge. Mm-hmm. They're not necessarily going to know until there's a problem that there's a different minimum wage if you live in Salem versus if you live in the Portland metro area or Eastern Oregon.
Yeah, Senator Denbrough, Senator Rosenbaum, yes, that's correct. And in fact, I mean, I can think of one occasion where we were contacted by an employee complainant to say that, you know, the employer in that situation did not know that the minimum wage had changed. And of course, we will intervene in those kinds of situations. And yes, I do foresee that this new unit, with its focus on making sure that wages are paid appropriately, will be looking at those kinds of issues and taking steps to correct it if they do come across situations where an employer is paying the incorrect minimum wage.
And then, so I have one more question on a different topic, but I'm happy to defer to other people.
Well, I will just say, Senator, that the wages have actually begun to diverge because there is one region that I think mm-hmm. did not have an increase, the frontier
right.
region.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So should I ask my last question?
If you must, yes.
So the federal government has adopted a rule dealing with overtime that will change eligibility for a lot of people who weren't formerly eligible for overtime. I don't even know if that's taken effect yet, but well, and you know what I'm talking
yes,
about?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. So how will that play out in Oregon?
Well, in Oregon, under Oregon law, we have a different measure for salary than the federal government does. The federal regulations do. However, I mean, an employer in Oregon needs to comply with the stricter standard. So once those federal regulations take effect, essentially an employer in Oregon, to be in compliance with state law, will have to pay, you know, the higher salary rate that's determined under the FLSA, the federal law. And so to the extent that we can, when we come across a situation at the Wage and Hour Division, for example, a wage claim that has that as an element to the claim, we will attempt to enforce the higher federal standard.
So we wouldn't just adopt the federal standard?
Well, to adopt the federal standard would require a statutory change, because the salary that we apply is defined in statute as the equivalent essentially of the minimum wage times 2,080 hours. So a full-time worker at the minimum wage divided by 12 would give you the monthly salary that is required to be in compliance with state law for the salary exemption. So if we were to want to match what the federal regulation says, I believe that would require a change in the statute.
But we still will be in compliance with the federal rule as well as our current scheme?
Correct. Under the minimum wage regulations, the administrative rules, there's a rule that says an employer must comply. If there's a divergence between what the federal regulations require and what the state regulations require, an employer must comply with the stricter of the two standards. In this case, it would be the federal regulation. It's the reverse with, for example, with minimum wage, where the federal minimum wage is less than the state minimum wage, and yet the employer has to comply with the higher standard.
Okay, thank you.
Well, let me just follow up. So then why do we have to change state policy if the effect of this will be that we'll have to apply the stricter federal standard?
Well, I'm not saying that necessarily that we do. I think under the rules that we have now, it's not in statute, but in rule, I think we have the ability to point employers to the fact that you have to comply with the stricter standard, and thus, you know, you must comply with the federal regulation, even though the state requirement for a salary exemption is less than that. The difference, although it's going to be a bigger difference now once the federal regulations are the new federal regulations take effect, there's always been, or there's for a long time, there has been a difference between what the state requirement is as far as the salary amount and what the federal requirement is. And, you know, we've managed to enforce it nonetheless.
So two questions. When does it actually come into effect, you know, the new federal?
Well, if it does go into effect, and I understand that there's a lawsuit to stop it from taking effect, I believe it's in December 1st, I want to say.
Okay. And if it is upheld and becomes the policy, would it make your job easier if we had, had that standard encoded in state statute?
I think it would give us more certainty in enforcing the law. I mean, I think the situation that we are in right now is, for example, if we are investigating a case where this is an issue, is to tell the employer, although this is not what state law requires, it is what federal law requires. You must comply with federal law. So let's resolve this here rather than the Wage and Hour Division referring the case, for example, to the United States Department of Labor to enforce. So from a legal point of view, I suppose, yes. I mean, for legal certainty, it would be better if there was alignment between the two, the state and the federal law. But up to this point, as I've said, we've made it work.
We can talk more about that. Mm-hmm. Yes, Senator Knoth.
Thank you, Chair Dembrough. Gerhard, you can't just, as a company, you can't just say, oh, I'm paying the minimum wage and therefore I'm going to make this a salaried position. There are more requirements than that for a business to not pay overtime mm-hmm. to a worker, correct?
Senator Knoth, you're correct.
Okay.
There are other criteria other than the salary rate.
I just wanted to be clear that businesses can't simply just say, hey, I'm paying the minimum wage, and therefore this is a salary position, and I'm not going to pay overtime.
You're correct.
Okay.
Okay, thank you very much, Gary.
Thank you.
Good. Okay, so folks, we're going to rearrange the schedule a little. Just because I know you're so anxious to hear about the labor statistics, I want to keep you engaged and hungry. We're going to move to the presentation on the Oregon Connections Program, and if those presenters would come up, that would be great. This is an indulgence to our good friend and colleague, Representative Reardon, who has a strong interest. He's a member of the youth employment work group, very strong interest in this area, and he needs to leave at 9:30.
Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you. The Oregon Connections Program is something that we heard about last week or 2 weeks ago at the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, and are very intrigued by not only what it is, but what it could be in terms of providing a platform and some infrastructure for some partnerships that we're really interested in with respect to youth employment. So, Heather, are you leading it off? No?
Well, I am going to pass it to my brilliant colleague to kick us off.
Hi, I'm Melissa Dubois. I'm the executive director of the South Metro Salem STEM Partnership. And we'd like to tell you a little bit about Oregon Connections, but the nature of this tool is really one that you need a little bit of backstory because mm-hmm. we're very much at a point where the evolution of the tool is just as important as the future of the tool. So understanding how the work began with our partnership, I think, is important to understanding where it could go. Our partnership began, we're one of the state's 11 STEM hubs. Our partnership began in about 2012 among a handful of school districts, industry partners, community colleges, and community partners. And much of the conversation here in this metro region was, how do we align all of the assets that we really have toward bringing youth forward into our workforce, engaging youth in STEM, which we all acknowledge is important for 21st century workforce. And a lot of the conversations were around the great work that's happening in so many classrooms, so many organizations, none of which was really aligned and which we weren't leveraging very well at all. So we were hearing from teachers and from industry that we have all of these great things to share, and we don't know how to do that. Industry professionals who wanted to volunteer in classrooms, wanted to bring their expertise to students, wanted to be able to give students an authentic look at what their classroom concepts look like in the real world, but didn't really have a good mechanism for doing that. It's really hard to call a school and say, you know, hey, can I come in, without any context. We learned that there were educators and businesses and organizations all around the metro area who were doing some of this work, who had great relationships that were having high impact on students, but none of those efforts were connected to one another. So if I had a great relationship with one company, you might have the same great a different great relationship with that company. We didn't know about each other, and we weren't using those relationships to make anything bigger or more systemic. We also lacked any data on how these interactions were impacting student education or how they were ultimately impacting the workforce. And finally, we had, as I said, a number of people doing some great work together, and it was a little bit luck of the draw whether students got into those classes or into those environments or not. A teacher in Salem might have great relationships with their regional workforce partners, with their regional employers, but just 20 miles outside of town, that distance was too far for a teacher in Malala or in Amity to have those similar resources. And so what we wanted to get to was to start to build the systems that would start to address some of these inequities and allow us to leverage and to draw data. Some of you might be familiar with this. This is called the SAMR model, and it's often talked about in terms of using classroom technology. And it's a range of experiences that might go from purely a substitution of technology, going from a worksheet to a web-based worksheet, all the way up to technology that really redefines how you're able to engage students. And I think that applies both to classroom models, which is what we engaged in early on in the South Metro Salem partnership, all the way to what our partners in the workforce boards do in terms of how they're able to interact with their partners, how they're able to access workforce resources to bring youth on board. We've seen it in all sorts of other situations where, you know, really the CD player was a substitution for tape decks before. Fast forward to MP3, and now, you know, I was in college during the Napster era. People were sharing files all over the world, not legally, but sharing all the same. And now we've completely redefined how we can access music or content. And that's all been, an evolution based on technology. For the most part, our industry relationships haven't changed in the same way. We're still looking to spreadsheets, which might be the substitution for our old Rolodexes, where maybe teachers are Googling people to figure out who does energy work in this region. We're emailing them, we're doing data searches. None of this is particularly efficient, and none of this leverages the relationships of our whole community. So when we built Oregon Connections, and I'm telling you this purely from the perspective of the South Metro Salem STEM Partnership, we were looking for the ability, a systemic ability, of our classroom teachers to connect with industry resources to bring that expertise to the classroom or take the classroom to the industry. We partnered with a company called Nepris. They do a fabulous job. They're a national company based out of Texas. And their wheelhouse is to access a database of thousands of STEM industry professionals to do virtual one-on-one real-time connections with students. So if I'm a teacher in Malheur County, I can ask for a rocket scientist and be having a real-time Skype-like conversation with someone, you know, at Kennedy Space Center. So these real-time connections. We in the metro area still thought that that person-to-person interactions were very important, and we have that density of industry to be able to do that. So we asked them to build on this additional capacity to their platform and to white label it for us. And we began by piloting that work here in the Portland Metro and Salem Metro regions. And then we started talking to some of our partners about how to make it more systemic, to bring additional partners on board.
And frankly, to sustain the work. So when this started, I was at Work Systems in the Portland Metro region at the time, at the local Workforce Development Board there, and we too had a tool, because what we heard from industry is we get contacted by dozens and dozens of organizations, schools, teachers, whatever, wanting to come out and go on company tours, wanting to have a guest speaker come into the classroom, and they were fatigued around that. And we had a tool at the time that was not really user-friendly in a way that was logical. It wasn't easy to use. And so we were in conversations with our colleagues at both the both of the STEM hubs that border the Portland metro area or are in it, and really saying, we have the same need, we have the same interest. We're both in the business of creating systems that are scalable, that are sustainable, and that are logical, that we can all benefit from. And so what we talked about is really going beyond STEM occupations and including all occupations. Could this be an organizing tool that we could use across workforce systems and education systems? Because as you know, Senator Dembro, from being on the Oregon Workforce Board, that really the primary resources that the local workforce boards receive is to really serve these out-of-school youth. So the young people, the 6 million young people in the country that are not completing high school. And so how do we do all of that together? And that's when we worked very closely with the Portland Metro and the South Metro STEM hubs to really think about, what is a sustainability plan? How can we bring our Rolodex to bear and your Rolodex to bear? How can you support the classroom learning that is so essential and, frankly, where the bulk of our young people are, whereas we can help support the workforce system and the career counselors in those areas? And so it was really crossing the workforce and education system so that it was coordinating in and out of school time for young people, and creating more career exposure opportunities. So seeing people that look like them in places of work. And also, we saw the potential for this to be utilized in rural areas. As Melissa said, in Amity, you might not have access to a nuclear engineer, but could we find one? Yeah, they can. The other thing is that it's really about a business service that coordinates and reduces the noise for the business community so that there are clear ways for them to engage. Because I think, as I said at the OWIB meeting when we presented, there is a really a continuum of work-based learning opportunities, internship and work experiences on one end, but just exposure to knowing that these careers exist is on the other. And so how do we open up the window that these young people have and look beyond those traditional careers of teacher, lawyer, doctor, the kinds of occupations they're exposed to see, oh, workforce development professional, oh, senators, oh, look at that, representatives, those are real. And so it was a way to make classroom learning real. And again, I just want to emphasize, this is a coordinating tool and will not replace the human capital that it takes to prepare young people for an opportunity, or that it takes to supervise a young person once they're, maybe in an internship. So it's certainly a tool that can be utilized for organizing those kinds of activities, but it can't replace the human capital that it takes to manage both sides. So that's how we got in.
And as Heather was getting to, there's our usage model, which is classroom to industry connections, but there's many other usage models. What the tool does really well is gives us the opportunity to facilitate either in-person connections or these virtual connections that I spoke of. The virtual side is taken care of by the developer as we figure out how best to implement that model in our various regions as is appropriate to our regions. What are the investments that make the most sense locally in terms of putting more effort into in-person, putting more effort into virtual sessions? The real attractive thing to me is this concept of leveraging. If I come to the system and I bring five of my partners, I'm accessing the five partners that five other users also use. Like that's the huge leverage point that I see with this work. The in-person elements do require a local industry database. Those people need to be in the region, and there needs to be someone who's there to facilitate and monitor those connections. So the tool, as Heather said, it doesn't replace the need for the on-the-ground staffing that needs to facilitate and moderate and drive some of this work, but it does help them organize.
I'm wondering if I can just add something, and just for everyone's edification, this is really a statewide tool that we were able to get funding for through both the workforce and the education systems, and but the implementation is local, and it's very customized locally. And so I just wanted to make that point in case people weren't clear on how it's being resourced.
Just to introduce myself, so my name is Whitney Swander, and I lead the Central Oregon STEM Partnership, or STEM Hub. We're working on moving towards a more partnership model. Another value that is really added by this Oregon Connections tool is can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. As industry has connected with classrooms, they've also said, we don't want this to just be a responsive process. It's not just about waiting for education to come and reach out to us. We have critical needs in our workforce, and we would like to expose young people to those opportunities as well. And so NEPRIS has this ability, kind of as within their entire network, to build in this opportunity for industry to also offer sessions. And from the Central Oregon perspective, some of our partners are already raising their hands and saying, we have really cool things going on. We have really cool work sites that young people aren't aware of. Do they know that there are large-scale research labs that are doing national and international impactful research? And how can we offer that opportunity for schools to come into our site? We can only do so many field trips during a day, during a school year. We can only host so many summer science nights or summer camps in our space. But potentially, by saying, you know, next Thursday, we'll do a live tour in a really fun and interactive way with students, you can run through a lab space and get, you know, a large portion of fourth graders, for example, in Central Oregon exposed to what a real-life research lab in their own hometown or their region looks like. I wanted to speak a bit to the management strategies and kind of how use Central Oregon as a model for ways that it can be adapted. So Melissa talked a bit about the nexus of the tool and how it has scaled from there. In Central Oregon, we see this as being really critical in the sense that in-person sessions are very useful. We have a number of growing STEM industries, but we also have students that are in really rural communities outside of where our metro space is. And so that's really a powerful piece, as you know, a company like Capsigel Bend Research is really interested in connecting with students in Warm Springs. But the hour and 20 minutes to drive there to do an hour presentation and the hour and 20 minutes to drive back is not necessarily, even though that is a local Central Oregon company and they assume those students as part of their network and their education network, it's not a feasible connection really to make, but a virtual connection does that. So Melissa gave that example of a rural student connecting with the Kennedy Science Station, but we see in Central Oregon that there's value in doing these connections even locally. For a bit more of how we're managing this in Central Oregon or planning to manage this is really a partnership between our STEM Hub, our CTE department, our Regional Achievement Collaborative. Economic Development for Central Oregon has come on board as a really strong partner. Opportunity Knox, which is a talent development and kind of incubation for professionals, as well as some key industries like SOAR Oregon, which is looking at expanding UAS technology or drone technology across our state. And so we each have different roles.
And obviously the board.
I'm sorry, yes, and the Workforce Investment Board.
It was a given.
Right, since she's sitting next to me. We each have different roles to play, and we each have different things to give. So from the STEM Hub's perspective, we're really providing some framework and some leadership around this, and also doing a lot of the initial baiting to get more teachers and more industry into this work. From the perspective of CTE, we have a number of kind of cross-pollination across our CTE programs in Central Oregon, but again, they don't necessarily talk to each other much. They have a few meetings through the year in which they are doing training and looking at policies and looking at shared resources, but as far as saying, who are your key contacts in the Deschutes National Forest, we don't have a way to really overlap those. The same in our school-to-career or school-to-work offices in our schools. Maybe within a single district, they're sharing spreadsheets about who are industry that want to host students for job shadows and for interviews. But across Bend to Redmond or Redmond to Sisters, there isn't the sharing of that information. And so it's a leap. But when we look at, as we tell people about the power of this tool and that power of the leverage that, I put five in and I get five squared back, we're seeing a big response to this. And then, as well, our Workforce Investment Board, our partners at the Oregon Employment Department, groups like SOAR and Economic Development are helping us really bring the right professionals into the tool as well, so it's not just one agency or one organization doing the lift. So the statewide investment has really purchased for teachers and industry the ability to really coordinate these in-person sessions. We can coordinate as many of those as we want, and then each user has access to do one virtual session and one industry session, or I'm sorry, one industry chat, one of those industry-offered sessions that may be a topic or a tour or something like that. And then from the local investment, this is, again, where there's a lot of choice. So for teachers to get more access to those virtual sessions, it's a $99 license per year, and you have those unlimited web interactions. So from the Central Oregon perspective, we're investing about $5,000 this year as a pilot for this, and CTE is also kind of, they're not matching, I wouldn't say match, but they're putting in a number of additional licenses for their instructors that want to engage in this as well. And again, it comes from that perspective of teachers being in Prineville and in Madras, they can really benefit from being able to connect with professionals in our Central Oregon area, across the state, and then internationally. And then also that local investment is our industry coming forward and saying that this is valuable and they want to participate.
We'd like to leave you just with, you're the workforce committee, but this is a teacher testimonial of how this work is impacting her classroom. Just about a minute.
Hi, my name is Toni Hansen, and I teach 7th grade science out in Newburgh. One way that Oregon Connections has impacted my teaching has been to really start from the beginning thinking about how can I make this opportunity for my students relevant, and how can I expose them to an engineering or medical field or conservation field that they might be interested in or don't even know that they're interested in until they actually meet somebody in that field. So I have been able to make connections through Oregon Connections with people in all sorts of different industries, from technology using radar and sonar to conservation to genetics labs at OSU. And even my 8th grade counterpart was able to bring somebody in from USGS to talk about volcanoes and the technology that they've been using to track volcanic activity. And as a result, the engagement that our students get is so much higher, and they're so excited to actually talk about what they've learned and to take that to other classes and connect some of their literature that they've been reading in their social studies class to the the presentation that they heard in science class. So it has been a really great opportunity to make those connections and actually bring real life experience into the classroom. And for some students, really start to get them thinking about where they want to go and what are they actually working for. So it has been an amazing tool for me, and I look forward to continue to use it and hopefully help expand it in the future. So thank you for those that are on Oregon Connections, and I look forward to seeing more of you that are interested in becoming part of Oregon Connections.
So we're on the front end of implementing this tool statewide, and we're very excited about the potential across education and workforce systems and economic development and frankly, the private sector, the folks that we have engaged have been very interested and are thinking of this as a an organizing tool so that when they get contacted by a one-off, they can say, we go through Oregon Connections now, connect with the administrators, which is us. So are there any questions that we can answer around this tool or how it could be utilized? I know you had some questions maybe around the internship pieces. Is there anything we can tell you more about? And I realized I didn't tell you. I'm Heather Ficht. I'm the director of the East Cascades Workforce.
Great. Yes. Talies, you have, I certainly have some questions. Yeah. So, you know, the Oregon Connections platform is just very exciting, certainly for the impact in the classroom. And, you know, that last testimonial just, you know, really reminded me of how a presentation like that, whether it's in person or, you know, or on the screen, but where it's very relevant to the student, can really be that spark that that just brings everything together. So, you know, as a parent, I'm very excited. Well, okay, as a grandparent, I'm very excited. you know, I do see also some wider applications. And, you know, one of the challenges that we wrestle with as we're dealing with youth employment is, you know, one of them, Heather alluded to, how do you get at those students who are not in school, right? And, you know, how do you make the connections for them? And then, you know, even for those who are in school, and maybe there are many programs out there for them, but they don't know about them because we're so driven by awareness as a function of funding stream, right? So you have all these parallel programs out there that they may not know about each other's existence. And, you know, certainly, you know, that student who's looking for work experience or the CTE teacher or, you know, STEM teacher who would like to get some work opportunity for the student may know about this, but the student doesn't fit the strict requirements of that grant program.
Right.
And so something that we've been wrestling with, certainly within the workforce world for years, is how to bring these silos together. So, you know, I guess I would just ask you to sort of imagine how a platform like this could help with that.
Well, one of the things that we're looking at in Central Oregon is not dissimilar from other areas I've been in, which is program-rich, system-poor. So we have a lot of great programs, and under the Youth Career Connect network, that is our regional achievement collaborative, really is under that umbrella, is looking at utilizing this to help organize some of that work. Where there are multiple nonprofit or community-based organizations that play in that space, and rather than saying there is one program with one structure, we're looking at a decentralized model where it's really agreeing on a standard of readiness for young people and then all comers. And so we're actually in the process of looking at how we might utilize this tool to really help with that. And as Whitney had clarified, you know, a business can put out a request. Well, so could a nonprofit organization when they have resources that are flexible, to be able to offer internships. And I know that
one of the challenges we have in Central Oregon is our young people don't stay. They move away because they don't know there are opportunities. And so for them to experience that both these career exploration activities and then be able to apply that in a workplace setting in the summer would be incredibly powerful to really retaining our emergent workforce and really getting them skilled to the careers that they need. So that is all on the table for us. And we're looking at ways to utilize it. Is that a fair representation?
It is. And the one thing I would add is our regional achievement collaborative together with the STEM Hub, we have a shared priority of industry in, mm-hmm. when we're talking about school, industries in and students out. And we always talk about it that way because it sticks in your head. It's really easy to envision what that is, mm-hmm. industry in, students out. And so when we think about internships, and the Youth Career Connect work around internships is not about merit-based work experience. It's not about being the best prepared and the mm-hmm. smartest student, and mm-hmm. that's who gets the internship. And so when we think about how Oregon Connections will help us connect students with work experience, it's not about posting a competitive application that, you know, 50 kids will apply for and one will get selected for. It's about adult-to-adult relationships. So if I'm a if I am a bioscience company and I'm willing and to host young people as interns, I can add that in my Oregon Connections profile to say that I'm willing. Not everyone will see that, but those people that are helping students connect with opportunities like CTE teachers, school to career folks, will be able to see as, you know, a certain student says, I'm really interested in this area. I don't really know what it means to work in that field. They can get connected through those caring adult sort of thing. So adult to adult, and it achieves that mission of students out into industry.
And that also counts for out of school time providers. Yeah. So we fund their licenses to get those virtual connections as well.
And you would make the contact with the out of school youth and then be the sort of intermediary to plug them into that.
Exactly. Exactly. And we partner across not just our WIOA youth providers, but any organization that is serving disconnected or re-engaged young people. We believe that's our lane, and we believe that that's our responsibility in preparing the emergent workforce, particularly since we have a labor shortage. You can't leave anyone on the bench. Everyone has potential. So how are we going to skill them up to the bar? Absolutely.
Colleagues, any questions? The notion of, you know, you have school to work, you have CTE, you have STEM. One of our goals, I think, as a committee, is to bring those three closely together. Mm-hmm. We will be, you know, we've entertained in the past the notion of just on an organizational level, bringing together the, the STEM Council and CTE and the people who are responsible, you know, who are doing that work, are providing us actually with a legislative concept to pursue that this year. So, I just believe that the more that we can create this, this sort of integrated vision, the better off we are. So. And I do see this Oregon Connections platform as having a role to play. Mm-hmm. So please be available to us.
And I would say as a microcosm to that work, at the High Desert Education Service District that's based out of Redmond, we have moved our regional CTE department and our STEM hub into a single department. So myself and Brooke Rich, who's the director of that that department, we are colleagues. We are constantly working together about not working parallel and really redefining how CTE and STEM really are extensions of one another as opposed to separate.
And I just want to applaud what you just said, Senator Dembro, because I think that is huge. We do a disservice for our young people when we can't figure that out. When we can't figure out how to get classroom learning to be relevant in the real world, when we can't when we silo and say CTE is blue collar and STEM is white collar. That's not true. It's not a true distinction, and it's old thinking, and we need to break all those silos down. And that's why I am so fabulously excited to work with brilliant colleagues like this who see the same future. And when we can focus on the young person and not our organizations or our own whatever bias, and we can all talk about that thing that's outside of us, and it's the student, I think, or the young person, frankly, it might not be a student, the better off we all are. So thank you for that. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yes. Senator Kim. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank you guys for the work that you're doing, because as we've seen over and over again, the key to raising graduation rates is to engage kids, mm-hmm. and CTE and STEM is a huge part of that effort. And what we've seen through the data, and I think we need to be data-driven on this stuff, mm-hmm. is that kids who are in those programs graduate at much higher rates. So you guys are, we're going to rely on you to help us raise graduation rates through these mm-hmm. programs. So thank you for what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
Okay. Thank you all for being here. Okay. We are not yet going to move to the employment statistics because we're going to ride this wave of school-work connection a little longer and hear from our friends from Salem Kaiser to hear about their CTEC work experience program. CTEC is a local CTE center here in Salem that is run by the Salem Kaiser School District with a lot of partnership with the Salem Chamber of Commerce. And the Youth Employment Work Group heard a presentation from Norma about the program there, and we were very excited about it. For anybody who's visited the CTEC Center, you know what an impressive operation that is. And if you've met any of the students who are in that program, they're ready to work. They're very, very inspiring young people. So we're going to hear about how CTEC is working at trying to give practical work experience to their CTE students.
Well, thank you for having us. Norma Sanchez, I'm the business liaison, and I am also a Salem Area Chamber of Commerce employee, so that's one way that we're connecting students. It's that to create a lot of partnerships through not just industry, but through our other organizations that are connected directly with industry.
Great. Senator Dembrough, committee members, thank you so much for having us. So I'm glad to hear that you're excited about CTEC, because so am I. So that makes me feel good. Senator Knopp mentioned that students who are engaged in...
You have to introduce yourself
sorry,
for the record.
Sorry, John Honey, the principal of the Career Technical Education Center in Salem-Kaiser School District. Senator Knopp talked about the number of students that graduate compared to who are in CTE programs versus students who are not, and you're absolutely right. A 15% jump for students who are involved in as few as two CTE classes in their high school career. We are in our second year now at the Career Technical Education Center, and just in our first year, we had a 94% graduation rate for the kids who are involved in our programs. And there are all kinds of kids. Five valedictorians and two salutatorians from our various high schools in Salem-Kaiser, but also students who were a 1.0 GPA and just did not see a purpose to going to school every single day because they want to go work, and they have some passion around it. Just very, very briefly, we are a program within Salem-Kaiser schools. We're not actually a technical – we're not a school, and so we – draw students from all of our resident high schools and the alternative program. They come to our place 2.5 days a week. And so they come for half a day on Monday, and then they're there either all day Tuesday, Thursday, or all day Wednesday, Friday. And we're doing two things that I think are very, very different and are really engaging industry and students and preparing each group to work with each other. The first thing that we do is every one of our programs has an industry advisory council. And they come to us, they meet on a regular basis, they work with Norma. We find those guest speakers, we find those guest demonstrators, guest lecturers. We go out and visit work sites and organizations. Those IACs, the industry advisory groups, help us guide our decision making around our curriculum. So I've been in education for a long time, and for 30 years we heard from industry that schools weren't creating ready-to-work kind of entry-level employees, but we never heard why. You know, we'd ask them, well, what do you need? And it was just crickets. And so now when we ask them those questions, we get very specific about, you know, what are the challenges that your company is facing today? What are the trends in your industry? And what are you worried about 5 or 10 years down the road? Because really, our students aren't ready to work right now. They're still in high school. But a couple years from now, when they graduate and they move out and they're ready to go, we want them to be ready. So I think that industry partnership, and it's a very close, tight relationship. We are shoulder to shoulder doing the same work. The other thing that we're doing that is different is that by having students in our building for an entire day, we're able to embed core curriculum. And, you know, the previous speakers were talking about making things authentic and making things real. We had a student in the first week of school last year tell our assistant superintendent that he liked CTEC because everything we do here is connected to everything else we do. And we never have students ask, why do I have to learn this math or why do I have to learn this English? Because that core curriculum is taught through the lens of CTE. So I'm wearing my McNary sweatshirt because that was the last school I was a principal at. And real honestly, we heard kids ask, you know, why do I need to know the Pythagorean theorem? Mm-hmm. Kids are not great with theory. They're great with rules, and every contractor in the world uses a 3-4-5 rule, which is the Pythagorean theorem. Why is it a rule in the real world, but it's a theory at high school? And so our students, they'd much rather spend the whole day out in the shop, but they are not reluctant now to go into English and math. We saw our passing rates in English 11 and 12, which is more of a technical reading and writing program at our school, and algebra, geometry, and financial algebra. We had less than an 11% failure rate. And it's not uncommon to see 25 or 30% failure rates at a resident school because there is a lack of connection. There's not a relevance. And so our students are doing great work. Our big goals at CTEC are to help students understand. We want to introduce them to industry and those opportunities that are out there. We want students to make purposeful decisions about their future. And real honestly, I don't really care what their decision is. I just want them to have a plan. And that plan could be a 4-year college, a community college, an internship, an apprenticeship, direct entry into the workforce, the military. There are a lot of different ways they can go. Students don't have to go to college just because they've always had a principal standing in front of them saying, go to college, go to college, go to college. And they don't have to go to work because they think they can't go to college. We want them to make those informed decisions, and then we want to help them plan and implement that plan. As we do those kinds of things, that helps industry. It helps our communities, it helps our students, it helps the economy. I mean, there's nobody loses in a model like that. And we're already seeing really good results with students who are out getting jobs right out of high school, making anywhere from $17 to $40 an hour if they're in some of those prevailing wage industries. And they're thrilled. I loved the comment, Senator Dembrough, that you made about finding a way to make school STEM and CTE activities, you know, and all come together. That's what we do. So our cosmetology students are taking chemistry and anatomy and physiology through a CTE lens. Our digital design students are learning physics because they want to design video games that look real, and they have to understand all those forces. And so now all of a sudden their interest and the core curriculum combine. They get together in our first robotics competition team, and they're designing and building and fabricating and writing code, and they're doing all of these STEM activities in a CTE setting, but it's all about getting ready for work. And so we talk a lot about everything we do is just work development. I used to think of myself as a principal. Now I think of myself more as a workforce development kind of coordinator. So it's good stuff. I'm going to let Norma talk a little bit about some of the different opportunities that we present for our students and for industry to really partner. So,
yeah. So as we talk to students about having a plan, we, you know, there's a difference between telling a student you need to have a plan and providing them the tools to create that plan. And what we're doing is really bringing together and creating a toolbox for them so that they can come up with a plan. And if that plan doesn't work, they have a plan B that they can go to. So a lot of the different things that we do for our students, it's really connect them with industry and get them in front of industry as much as we can to get them exposed to all the different opportunities that they can have. Because even our students within construction or manufacturing or digital design or cosmetology, those are really broad industries that can lead to many, many different things. And we want our students to understand that. So we do it through classroom presentations, bring in people from industry to talk about what their expertise areas are, how they got started, get in front of the students to talk about, you know, I was in high school once, I didn't know about this career that I'm in right now, and now, you know, I didn't know I could be an underwater welder. And it's a thing, and you could do it too, and let me tell you more about it. Or, you know, we have students who are in our construction program, but they want to be architects. Well, let me tell you how this is going to really be really helpful, you know, because it's just going to make you a better architect. You're going to be designing buildings that can be built, and you're going to be able to communicate with other people. And that's another thing that we are encouraging all of our industry partners that come in is when you talk to our students, talk about their professional skills or soft skills that you want and in your employees and that you were asked as an employee. We do it through our mentoring program, and our mentoring program, it's, again, reinforcing those professional skills, exposing students to more careers, and really getting connections. You know, I was talking to one of our I'm getting alumni coming now, and this is our first year, and how many people can say that they have alumni coming back and just hanging out and visiting during their lunchtime from work to just come in and say hi to their teachers, to see what else is new with CTEC, and to figure out other ways of getting connected. And because we're providing those opportunities before they leave, and we're always trying to think of new ways and easier ways, because we're dealing with a, you know, the end of the millennial generation and the beginning of the Generation Z. So we need to figure out how to best reach out to them after they leave, before they leave, how to keep them engaged. And so I'm getting students coming back and asking, you know, I've had this job, or I'm going to be applying for an apprenticeship program, and just kind of getting them connecting through those tools. I had a student yesterday who came in, and he's applying for an apprenticeship program, and he knows the apprenticeship people already because they were their they were his mentors. So making those connections, you know, a lot of times is not necessarily what you know, but who you know. We're getting to students to get them, we're getting them to build that network for themselves as well. Site visits, you know, not just bringing industry to the classroom and getting to see what they're doing, but taking them to see that what they're doing in the classroom, in the shop, is what they are going to be expected to do out in industry, because our teachers are coming directly from industry and they have industry expectations. When I walk someone through CTEC, I tell them that CTEC is not for a student who wants to hide from school, because students here work twice as hard. They have to be students and they have to be representing, meeting industry standards at the same time. So they have to be students and employees. We provide job opportunities, or and that we tied it last year with our career fair. Last year being our first year, our idea was to have a career fair for students to, again, get exposure, get knowledge about their opportunities. But then we have industry telling us, your students are ready. All of my mentors were telling us, I am ready to hire some of your students because they are just ready. They're way better than what we're getting from the street. They're much more prepared. They have the technical skills, but also those professional skills skills that we're looking for. And so they were really the push behind having a job fair where students did mock interviews throughout the year. And then at the May career fair last year, they actually got to interview for actual jobs. And a lot of our students were, you know, going through a second interview and were offered some summer jobs. The trouble we run into is that we're dealing with industries that ask for 18, it tends to be a problem for us because our students are often underage.
Because of equipment
right.
restrictions?
Safety and, yeah. I've had students coming to me and asking me to, we don't have a job shadow program set. We do kind of more informal things with our job shadow program, but I have most of the requests have been coming from students because they want to learn about an industry. So once they talk to their mentors, once they have gone in site visits and had presenters in their classroom, they're eager to learn more. And so they're reaching out, which is great to see students do because they're no longer just sitting and waiting for someone to tell them what to do, but they're being proactive and they're actually reaching out to find more resources to get more knowledge about what they want to do.
So I'd like to add to that a little bit. Finding job shadows for 1,000 juniors and seniors in a school year is a bit of a challenge. And so what we've done out at CTEC is we've been able to create an authentic learning environment for students that is actually on our own campus. So when we're all at capacity, we'll have 10 different programs at the Career Technical Education Center. Here's the big vision. Imagine our construction students building a greenhouse that our agri-science students use to grow fruits and vegetables in, that our culinary arts students then prepare and serve out of a food truck that our manufacturing students build that gets painted by our collision repair students with a logo designed by our business marketing kids. We drag the whole thing out to Sprague High School for a softball tournament. We launch our drones. We take the video that gets edited in our video production program. And then we set up a virtual studio in our digital design program where students from our cosmetology program are the on-air talent describing this promotional event. That's the way the world works. All those businesses are connected, and our students are starting to see that. They talk about return on investment, and we don't even teach ROI, but they're with those industry partners who that's their lifeblood, mm-hmm. and so they're learning it. And so that's really the beauty of what we're doing here is that even for a student who maybe can't find that job shadow opportunity, they're doing real work. We are not making birdhouses and tin snip toolboxes. We're building 1,800 square foot houses. We're doing piecework for local companies. They're getting real practical experience.
I think that's all we have. So
what questions do you have for us?
Yes. So I'd like you to, it sounds like in a lot of ways you're living in the ideal world now, but let's think even a more ideal world. Uh-huh. You know, it seems to me that it would be great if your students could have practical work experience, say, during that summer between their junior and senior year, and then once they've graduated, you know, for those who, you know, including for those who are going to go to college, you know, are going to have a practical work experience after that senior year as well, or you know, perhaps even their CTEC experience becomes a certified pre-apprenticeship program, which allows them to go straight into an apprenticeship. How can we make that happen?
I'm actually glad that you mentioned that because I was like, oh, we're done. And I was like, oh, I feel like there's something missing. We are actually doing some of that already. And we, instead of having an internship program for our students, we wanted to provide something that they can take with them beyond high school and beyond saying, I practice this in a way that it doesn't seem real to an employer. Instead, we wanted to create opportunities for them to put something in the resume that says, I've done this, I have experience,
now I want to continue to grow. And so we stay away from an internship and created an entry-level employment opportunity for our students. So when I'm talking to industry members and they want to come in and interview our students, we're talking about creating agreements where, okay, you're going to hire our students, but we want you to provide with an entry-level employment opportunity for them. And that means that it can be 6 weeks at least where you can host a student as an employee, and that, you know, it leaves a lot more flexibility because then the students are employees, right? So they are expected to be such in their work environment. And so they're learning and they're expecting things, but they also know that it's safe because it's their first time having this type of, you know, a job within industry, and our employers know that. And so that's what we're calling those experiences. A lot of our students were able to get, yesterday I was talking to one of our juniors, current senior, and he was in a program last year and he was able to get one of those opportunities. And he was talking about it and how he's now going to be able to put that in front, you know, that in his resume. And the next time he applies for a job, he's going to get a much better job because now he has that experience with him.
Yeah, and those entry-level work experiences come for, essentially they're designed for students who have completed our program. They've earned industry certification, OSHA certified ladder safety training or the hand and power tool OSHA certification. CPR first aid, they've participated in a random drug testing protocol through Biomed. So they can do those things. We give our students actually what we call a skills verification form where they have met specific industry standards to the proficiency level demanded by industry. And they give us that information through those industry advisory councils. So we're really giving students that opportunity to learn about school, but learn about work in a way that work wants them to learn. It was fun. We had an engineering company come out and meet with some of our students, and I loved the guy's comment because he said, we would much rather hire an engineer who knows how to turn a wrench. And so we have students out there doing that. I want to be a mechanical engineer, but I'm taking manufacturing. I want to be an architect, and I'm in a construction class. That's the disconnect, is the guy who designed it with the gal who built it. We want them to understand the same language.
And then so there's two things. You also asked about like the apprenticeship programs and all of those. We are working with apprenticeship programs to try to get our students direct entry or have them have CTEC count as their pre-apprenticeship so that they can move to the apprenticeship faster. So we are working with those, really building those relationships to make that happen. And then the other thing is, when you said, what can we do to make that happen more for our students? Our students are eager to work and to learn how to work. I've heard comments from some adults saying, oh, you know, this generation, younger generations are lazy, they don't want to work, they don't want to do anything. I don't think it's that. I think it's they haven't been presented with the opportunities because our students have proven that they want to work. You know, I have students coming and asking me, like, I want to work in this area. Can you find me? They help me get connected to so I can get a job. And so, but for us, at least what we've discovered so far is age has been a factor where if we had more companies or more businesses who would feel safe bringing in younger students or younger youth to work for summer, you know, during the summer for those entry level opportunities, I think that would create a lot more opportunities for our youth.
Or a simpler process for giving the companies those exemptions.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is they can apply for an age exemption through BOLI, but it's costly and it's time consuming.
That's an interesting thing for us to look at. Yeah, thanks for that. Well, I would think that an employer would be more willing to hire someone to take a chance on a young person if they were getting a strong recommendation from the teacher, from the school itself. But John, what do you see as the role of the school in helping to send the right people to the right jobs?
Yeah, I'll re-reference the skills verification form. So So our manufacturing group, our construction program, the cosmetology group, they're looking for very specific demands or expectations from industry. And then they want to know at what level of proficiency does a student need to be to get that first job. And then we just check them off, literally check. There's a checklist that says this student can do this thing, this student can do that thing. This student has 90%. Like we expect, we won't mark off on attendance unless they're there 94% of the time. So you know the kid's going to have great attendance. And what we hear from industry is they come every day, they can pass a drug test, and they have a driver's license. I mean, those are the three big barriers in construction and manufacturing. And so we can verify that there's a greater likelihood of this potential employee meeting those standards. They've participated in random drug testing voluntarily. Here's the form that says so. And with no positive tests. Here's their attendance report, 94%. Here's their behavior record. You know, they had no major discipline issues. And when we share those things with them, they're already at the front of the hiring or interview line. But then when we say, and here's their technical skills, and here's their work experience, and here's the college credit that they earned, and and we go through all of those things, now all of a sudden they're right at the top, if they're not the top.
And just to add to that, something that we're going to be doing this year, and it's led by our English teachers, is going to be a student portfolio, and it's going to be different than the regular high school portfolio, because the idea behind this is that they want something real that students can use, not something so generic that a lot of times students complete a high school portfolio and it's just like, check, right? It's done. You can graduate. This is going to be something that they are going to have a resume that their mentors are going to look over. They're going to use that resume to go through our career fair. They'll have work samples that are related to industry. So that's just going to add up to support the skills verification form.
So your local community college is Chemeketa Community College. Do you have a relationship with them? Are your students getting dual credit for this?
They do.
How does that work?
So every program that we implement, we tie to a community college somewhere. So there's no construction program currently at Chemeketa, so our construction program is through Portland Community College. There's no cosmetology program at Chemeketa right now, so we're connected to Mount Hood Community College. Our manufacturing students, there's a great manufacturing program at Chemeketa, probably one of the best ones in the valley, or maybe the state. And so our students are connected there. So every student has the opportunity to earn those community college credits that are oftentimes transferable. They're certainly looked upon with favor by local industry people. Additionally, so our students get a high school diploma. They have the opportunities for college, dual college credit, and then industry certification like OSHA certification. Or in the case of cosmetology, working with the state licensing board in cosmetology to make sure we're meeting those proficiency standards.
Colleagues, you have any questions? I think I've exhausted everyone with my questions. But
just one quick question. It sounds like you are doing great things here in your program. I'm just curious how you select the occupations or workforce areas that you're offering. I saw on your, it looks like you're expanding gradually to new programs every year.
Yeah, so it's a 5-year rollout plan with 2 programs per year until we have that total of 10.
And how do you decide which ones to offer?
Yeah, so what we did is we spent about a year planning before we ever even began to implement. And so we had a local steering committee made up of local industry partners. We met about every 3 weeks or so for about a year. Lots of data collection through Bureau of Labor and Industries, going out to specific industries and really kind of exploring. We discovered finding that right data is hard, as you all know. But for example, in the collision repair, if you look at the labor statistics, there doesn't seem to be a lot of demand for labor in collision repair, primarily because they're looking at companies that have more than 10 employees. But if you start looking around the valley and the state, these smaller companies are dying for labor collision repair technicians. And so we tried to find things that were high wage, high demand, high interest. or high skill. And so as we had identified those different things, these are kind of areas that we came up with. The other thing we were looking at is, do these industries that we've selected have transferable skills? And so manufacturing, we use a metals fabricating program at our school, but it's not just about metal. If you can run a CNC plasma cutter to cut steel, you can run CNC equipment in about 1,000 other industries. And so we're really looking kind of at things that are representative of multiple career opportunities and pathways for students.
And just a final, so are healthcare occupations something that you've considered? It seems like that's one of the shortages that everybody is facing, not just here in Oregon.
We did look at that. One of the challenges, right or wrong, the way we kind of ended up looking at it was there's a high demand right now. We were trying to find industries that we thought would be sustainable over the long haul. And as we started looking at the medical field, one of the questions that we kind of came up with is there's a huge demand right now because of the aging population that we have. And we're literally kind of a dying market. I know that's kind of callous to say.
But it's a very odd way to think about it, because it seems like the population is also growing at the younger end.
Right. One of the challenges we were looking at was that ebb and flow of demand. And so these are 30, 35-year career jobs. And so as we're pushing really hard right now to fill those positions, then we started thinking about, well, if we keep pushing kids into these same positions, if there's less demand for those jobs, but yet people are in 35-year careers, are there going to be more careers, say, 15 years down the road? So we kind of were challenged a little bit with that. We also started thinking, if we're pushing 50 kids out just in the Salem-Kaiser area every year, would we be flooding the market? And we're trying to invigorate our own economy first, and then the rest of the state. And so we're just trying to figure out the local demand, and we weren't sure that it could support the number of students that we were hoping to push into the industry every year. And so it was right on the edge. It was actually the last program that we didn't select. So.
Interesting. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, well, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you
very much. All right, folks, here's the moment that you've been waiting for.
We were waiting for the work group reports.
You'll have to wait a little longer for that. Nick Vlachek. Nick is going to be talking to us just about the general state of our employment, unemployment, the most recent figures, but then he's also going to go on to focus on the area of youth employment, where he's been a very active member of our work group, helping us to understand just where we are in terms of youth employment. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. My name is Nick Belachix. I'm the state employment economist for the Oregon Employment Department. And as Senator Dembro introduced me, I'm going to talk about the current labor force statistics and youth employment statistics. Starting off with the current labor force statistics, things look really good in Oregon right now in terms of the amount of jobs that we're creating. Full throttle job growth here is in quotes, because I'm borrowing that from the economists at the Office of Economic Analysis, but I like the imagery, totally agree with it, so I'm running with their description of full throttle job growth. Oregon has been adding jobs at a faster rate than the nation for the past 4 years. Right now, we're tied with Idaho for the fastest job growth over the last year of any state. We're both at 3.3%. That's much faster than the U.S. rate of 1.7%. Oregon recently added more jobs in a 12-month period than we ever have over the last 25 years. That's as far back as comparative records go for this data series. And Oregon's unemployment rate was recently the lowest that it's been in the last 40 years. Again, that's the furthest we can go back with comparative data. It's recently increased during the summer as more people join the labor force, and it takes a while for them to find jobs. But if this fall is anything like the last few years, they'll find work or go back to school, and the unemployment rate will start going down again in the next couple of months. And the strong...
No, it's just an amazing statistic.
The strong job growth and the tight labor market is also boosting labor force participation rates, which is facing a downward decline due to demographic factors, which I'll talk a little about a little bit later. But the strong job growth has actually led to an increase in the labor force participation rate right now.
Nick, could you, just for the record, explain the distinction between unemployment and labor force participation?
Yes. Chair Dembro, members of the committee, unemployment rate, the unemployment is anyone who's actively looking for a job but doesn't have a job. They've been looking for sometime in the last 4 weeks, they want a job, they're trying to find one. Labor force participation rate is those who are unemployed plus those who are employed. So they're either working or they're actively trying to find a job, divided by the civilian non-institutional population over the age of 16. So we have the labor force, the population, labor force participation rate is this ratio. Unemployment are those who are actively looking for jobs but can't find them.
So among the participation rate includes older people who may be retired?
Yes. So as more of the, this is one of the factors that leads, one of the demographic factors that's leading to the fall in the labor force participation rate. As more baby boomers reach retirement age and leave the labor force, they bring down the labor force participation rate. And the youth labor market has improved a lot. It's still not great, especially for teenagers, which will be the focus of the second half of this presentation. So this graph shows the over-the-month job gains in Oregon, going back to 2007, and you can see the huge job losses suffered during the recession. But if we go over to the cheerier right side of the graph and look at all the months in a row of job growth, you have to go back 51 months before you find a month of job losses. So we have this record setting 50 months of job gains. Again, haven't seen that in the past 25 years. Over the last 5 years, the average number of jobs being added each month have increased. And this year, the average number of jobs added each month is 4,800. The same as last year, so we're on track to have another good year of job growth in 2016. Now we can look at that by areas of the state, and nearly all areas of Oregon are adding jobs at a pretty fast rate. Could look at it a variety of ways, but I happen to have it here by local workforce development board area, and can see East Cascades with over-the-year job growth rate of about 4.4%, which is very high. But all the areas are seeing really good rates of job growth. Eastern Oregon has the lowest over-the-year job growth rate of 1.5%. If we had talked a couple of months ago, it would have been much higher, over 2%. But in Morrow County, they recently finished up construction of a power plant, which was a huge project. And so those jobs are coming out of these statistics, and it's slowing the overall growth rate we're seeing. So kind of an interesting example of how one big project can affect the job growth trend in Eastern Oregon. So there's probably someone listening who's saying, yeah, Nick, you're saying there's a lot of job growth, but, you know, are these just low-paying, not very good jobs? And the answer is a resounding no. Job growth is across all industries, and it's we're adding a lot of jobs in low-paying industries, in mid-paying industries, and in high-wage industries. So the chart here shows the over-the-year number of jobs added in each sector. Professional and business services has added nearly 15,000 jobs over the last year, and the average wage is 64,000, much higher than the average wage of 48,000 for the overall, for all of Oregon private sector. The next sector with the most number of jobs is healthcare and social assistance, which has an average wage of 50,000. Then we get into leisure and hospitality, a lot of jobs being added, but the average wage is under 20,000. Then fourth on the list there is construction with an average wage of $53,000 per year. Construction is also the fastest growing industry in Oregon right now.
Nick, do these numbers distinguish between full-time and part-time?
Chair Dembro, no, these are just jobs, but the average wage is a factor of both full-time and part-time work in those industries. And then another look at wages is the average hourly wage in the private sector in Oregon. Adjusted, this graph shows it over the past 8 years, adjusted for inflation, and really there hasn't been much job growth, which we've heard about during the recovery until the last year and a half. And the average wage in Oregon is on the rise, and it's risen about a dollar per hour over the last year and a half. And so the labor force participation rate is on the rise because the strong job growth, the tight labor market, the real increase in wages is naturally going to draw people into the labor force. They're either moving to Oregon, they're taking jobs instead of going to school, maybe they're able to find a job while they're in school, maybe they were doing something else when the job market was weaker and now they're back into the labor force. But over the last year and a half, we've seen the labor force participation rate rise in Oregon. It's still the downward trend. There's still a downward trend caused by demographic factors, which has to do with older workers leaving the labor force, as we already talked about, and younger workers, which I'm going to talk about in a little bit. But both Oregon and the U.S. are facing a downward trend in labor force participation rate, but our job growth right now is so strong that it's making up for some of the longer downward trend. So moving on to the youth employment section of this presentation. Most of the information here I'm going to provide is an update to data that was published in our 2014 report about the youth labor force in Oregon. And the report, our research found that a lot of the decline in youth participation has to do with them focusing more time on school and school-related activities. So that's kind of a supply-side issue where they're less likely to work because they're doing other things. But it also has to do with older workers filling jobs that were traditionally held by younger people. So that's more of a demand-side issue where employers could find older workers to do the job they used to hire young people for. And so economists think there's about a 50-50 split over the cause, but don't really know for sure. We just know that those are big factors in the decline of youth participation. Unemployment rates increased dramatically during the recession for teens and young adults. And in the last couple of years, they've improved a lot for young adults, but they haven't improved much for teenagers at all. This graph shows the unemployment rate for teenagers. That's the top blue line. For young adults 20 to 24 years old, that's the orange middle line. And for those 25 years and older, that's the bottom dotted line. And so the unemployment rates for those 20 and older have pretty much returned to the long-term average rate, but you can see the unemployment rate for teenagers is still really high. Now, young people, those 16 to 24, they tend to be overrepresented among the unemployed. So they make up just 12% of the labor force, but they make up 27% of unemployed Oregonians. So the unemployment rate for young people is always higher. They have more barriers to employment, less experience. But one thing that's different now compared to previous generation is of those unemployed teenagers, they're much less likely to have prior work experience. And we know employers are looking for prior work experience when they're trying to fill vacancies. They tell us that in surveys. So the blue line here shows the share of unemployed people by age group with no previous work experience. And so the blue line's the teenagers. It used to be about 1/4 of teenagers who were unemployed hadn't worked before. Now it's about 1/2 of unemployed teenagers haven't worked before. And the orange line is for young adults. They're more likely to have previous work experience, but still it's they're less likely to have previous work experience than before the recession.
Is that specific to Oregon, or is that just U.S. data?
I had to switch over to U.S. data for this series. I don't have it for Oregon. I'm sorry. Okay. I imagine that Oregon and U.S. are showing similar trends in this area. And for youth labor force participation, again, it's defined as a share of the civilian non-institutional population that is employed or unemployed. So young adult participation has increased a little bit as economic conditions improved, but teen participation rates, which have been on a downward trend since the year 2000, have continued to fall, even though there's been a lot of job growth and the labor market has tightened up quite a bit. So this graph shows the labor force participation rates in Oregon over time. And see the top line shows the young adults, how it has also decreased over the last 15 years or so, but it's increased as the job market has heated up. The bottom line shows the teenage labor force participation rate, and it's just facing downward trend still. It used to be a generation ago that over half of teenagers were either working or looking for work. Now it's just about 1/3 of teenagers are working or looking for work. So someone asked me, hey Nick, maybe it's just because teenagers can't earn enough for it to be worth it for them to work anymore. So I pulled some numbers, had to change the age groups because it's a different data set, and there's something to that, I think. This graph shows the average monthly earnings adjusted for inflation over time since 1990, and the top line shows the overall average earnings for all ages. And of course, average earnings are lower for younger workers, but you can see in each of those age groups, the top line there is 20 to 24 years old, and the middle line's 19 to 21 years, and the bottom line's 14 to 18 years old. Each of those age groups, their earnings peaked around 2000, have declined over time, even after adjusting for inflation, and have increased a little bit during the recovery, but still below the average earnings of the year 2000. And ultimately what this has led to is much fewer young people employed in Oregon's workforce today than before the recession and going back to the year 2000. So this together from that 14 to 24 age group, there are 26,700 fewer young people working in jobs than there were in 2007, even though the overall economy has regained the jobs lost during the recession, and there's 51,000 more jobs than there were in 2007. You can see in the last couple of years, young adults have been making quite a bit of comeback, and even teenagers have, but they're still way below pre-recession levels and 2000 levels. And so that's it for my prepared remarks. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Senators? Great. Well, thank you, Nick. You economists are so good with the quantitative information. If you would only give us the answers as to why this is all happening. But it is, you know, I think as you've shared with our work group and this committee earlier, there are many reasons that are driving youth unemployment, and there's not a simple answer to that. Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
So, colleagues, let me take the last few minutes of this meeting just to report on the work groups. Initially, the one on youth employment, as you know, we've been talking about this a lot today, hearing some of the results and some of the intriguing programs that the work group has heard about. Just to back up, you'll remember that this work group was created really for two reasons. You know, one being just an ongoing concern about youth employment and how we could be doing a better job of getting youth that first job or that work experience that's going to help them to get subsequent jobs. But also there was a concern that with the increase in the minimum wage, would that create further disincentives to youth to be hired? And so we went into this trying to find some answers to those questions. You know, as I mentioned, Nick gave us a lot of the statistical information. You know, one of the things that we saw early on was that there's actually not a clear connection between youth employment and minimum wage levels. The states are kind of all over the place on their youth employment levels, youth unemployment levels, and some of the states that had the highest levels of youth unemployment had their minimum wage at the federal level, you know, which is much lower, and that it seemed that youth unemployment tended to be connected to generally to overall unemployment. Those states that had high unemployment in general tended to have higher youth unemployment. But Oregon has one of the highest youth unemployment rates in the nation. So we do have a problem here. And we do, you know, I believe, need to find ways to, you know, to incentivize higher levels of employment among youth. So we talked about this in terms of really three areas. One was investments in youth programs. We saw a lot of improvements during the brief period of the stimulus ARRA programs, where we got a lot of federal dollars that we were able to put into summer programs and things like that for youth. Saw a lot of improvements in our numbers during that period, but that money, of course, was short-lived. It evaporated. And so would there be merit in us kind of replicating those programs or doing things like that? And that led to us having a lot of conversations with people from the CTE world about better CTE connections. We talked about, you all may remember that one of the bills that we passed last session was a funding package for youth unemployment. I think this committee passed it unanimously. Unfortunately, our colleagues in Ways and Means were not as enlightened, and it didn't make it through. But that was, of course, during the short session. And, you know, I think there was broad agreement among the work group that we should take another shot at that in the long session, as well as look at ways to make better connections between school and work, some of the things that we talked about today, you know, some other programs where the students are not only getting employment, but are also getting counseling and kind of wraparound so that they're working on their soft skills as well as just having the work experience. We talked about perhaps having a sub-minimum wage for workers, again, looking at the you know, the challenge of the rising minimum wage. Well, would the answer to that be, let's have a special youth wage or a training wage? The more that we looked at it, the less interest there was in that for a variety of reasons. We asked members, and it was a broad group of government and worker advocates and industry advocates for examples of sub-minimum wage programs around the country that worked, and we're not able to find any. There was, I think, universal sense that that was not a route to go down. But there was a lot of interest in looking at potentially a tax credit that would incentivize employers to hire youth. Anthony Smith from NFIB, who is part of the work group, put together a proposal that would be a stimulus incentive for employers, which I would say the work group in general found very intriguing, and we are pursuing it. We talked about it at length at our last meeting, which is just a couple of days ago, and there are a lot of questions still about how this would work. Our desire, if we can pull this off, would be to make it a tax credit where the employer would not have to wait until the end of the year to get the credit, but it would be something that perhaps through the vehicle of withholding taxes get a quicker return by having to submit a lower level of withholding. Could hold on to that and then, you know, use it for the business's purposes. You know, there's still a lot of talk about the sideboards that could be put on in terms of employer size, in terms of region, in terms of a variety of factors, remembering that a tax credit is ultimately a government expense, right? It's a budgetary expense, and so we probably will have to put limits on it and not have it be something that's wide open. So how can we design the program in order to get the biggest bang for the buck? And so those conversations will be ongoing. We will certainly be putting in a placeholder bill as we are continuing to work on what this program could look like. And again, Anthony's here. I just want to thank you for taking the lead on this. I think that covers it. You know, the work that we've done so far as a work group. Be happy to answer any questions about that.
I mean, my only thought is that with a 40-year low in the unemployment rate in Oregon, it stands to reason that younger people would have to be starting to be able to compete for jobs, but probably the training and skills issue is a barrier. I mean, because where are employers going to go when they need workers? I guess they could go out of state if there really are a lot of people and people are still moving to Oregon. And then my only other thought, and I see the employment department people have left the room, but I wonder, are they still here? Yeah. Oh, well, yeah, these employment people, but the unemployment insurance people is, in terms of the tax credit, is there any possibility of using the unemployment insurance system as a place where subsidies programs could be set up? Because I know we have these programs, you know, for employers that would have otherwise had to lay people off to be able to apply for using their unemployment insurance taxes being deferred or reduced. So I wonder if that's a place, given that, you know, we've got a declining unemployment, where we might also be able to address the the youth subsidy.
That's a good suggestion. We haven't talked about it. There was a certain amount of nervousness on the part of the work group of tampering with the unemployment insurance. That could potentially be a vehicle. Okay, so let me just move on to the second work group. And by the way, before I go on, I just, as always, need to acknowledge the great work of Jan Nordland in managing these work groups. The conversations at, you know, each of these meetings, whether it was the youth work group or the scheduling work group, were really robust and involved bringing in a lot of people to get outside perspectives, and Jan is just very good at that.
Thank you.
So the work group on schedules that work, just to remind you, this came out of a conversation that began in the 2015 session, where the legislature put a moratorium on local governments from instituting policies, you know, determining work schedules for people who lived in their jurisdictions, with the assumption that the legislature, that we wanted to give the legislature the first crack at talking about what such a program could be and could look like. And so this work group was put together to initiate that conversation. And just, you know, to back up for a moment, the problem that this work group was addressing is what appears to be a growing tendency in some industries to use what's called just-in-time work scheduling. So an employee might find out their assignment for the following week just, you know, the Friday before or over the weekend before. And for workers that are part-time and are juggling multiple jobs, or who have family responsibilities and childcare responsibilities, this is becoming a, you know, an increasingly difficult problem. And it's something that we are seeing a lot of, particularly within the retail and hospitality industries. So the work group spent a lot of time just coming to an understanding of the problem statewide, nationally, you know, both anecdotally and through statistical analysis. And we also look closely at a couple of initiatives that have been taken up by local governments to address this, notably in San Francisco and most recently, actually, the ordinance was just adopted a few days ago by Seattle. And so, you know, we had conversations over the phone through, thanks to the talented help of our IT department, IS department, with some really good online conversations with people in those cities, and learned a lot about the programs and the decisions that, that were made there. Both of those programs are limited to very large employers that are located in the largely in the retail and hospitality areas, you know, chain type stores or chain restaurants. They require the employers to give employees 2 weeks' notice of their schedules so they can have some stability. And then there are other details of the programs. And I would say that, you know, among the members of the work group, there is a lot of interest in us developing a program like that here in Oregon. So you can expect some legislative proposals around that. And, you know, the conversation will recommence, I think, through the legislative process. So, Jen, did I miss anything?
No, I mean, just that the Seattle did pass, and we did spend a lot of time looking at the very specific elements of that and how that might be different for Oregon. Mm-hmm. Seattle seemed to be the, they learned, we heard that they learned from the way that the San Francisco policy was set up. They learned how to make better for employers and better for work employers and employees, but Seattle was the focus.
Yeah, okay. Any questions about that, colleagues? All right, great. Stay tuned on that one. Okay. Do we have anything else for the good of the whole?
I do want to, Mr. Chair, just point out that before you, I had left a background briefing. Maybe you've seen these in some of your other committees. Our office, there's over 100 background briefs, and every year, every 2 years, we update them. We add new ones. We retire some of them. Attached is the workers' comp. Just as an example to you, it's a good idea. Maybe share it with your LA, your staff people, that it's a resource if you're fielding questions from your constituents. They're on the website. The public can access them. Members can access them. And we're happy to take your feedback. If there's issues that you don't see that are ones that you would like our office to address, we'd love to hear that.
Thanks for that, Jan. Yeah, this is a real resource that we don't use enough, and we should.
We used to print them and put them in a big binder for every member. I think maybe that helped, and they were at least visually on your shelf, but we don't do that anymore. It's all paper.
For all of us who are 50 years old or older, that was really helpful.
You liked the paper copies?
Yeah. It's just, it gets harder and harder to read on these screens.
Thank you. We'll keep that in mind.
Okay. Well, thank you, colleagues. We're adjourned. We're adjourned.